The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
We're back! I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his elderly aunt, Mark Hadley. Welcome back to The Big Picture, episode 44, I have indeed, for the week beginning January 31st and our first show for 2016.
Hurrah!
Ha-ha! Yet another teen vision coming up. It looks like it's 2015 all over again. An apocalyptic future with The Fifth Wave.
Yet another Quentin Tarantino bloodfest with The Hateful Eight.
And yet another good reason to go to the cinemas, the true investigative drama Spotlight.
All of that coming up on the show. Great to be back here, Mark.
It is
lovely
actually
to see your charming face, which is always good for radio.
With added charm.
Now with added charm.
Well, before we get too involved in how much we love each other, let's move on to this week. What we'll be watching this week, Ben, what's coming out?
Well, mate, given we're already deep into 2016, my couple of recommendations of things that are around at the moment are things that have been around for a while now, such as The Revenant. If you haven't seen The Revenant, go check it out.
You should. It's going so well overseas in Australia.
And here it actually knocked Star Wars off the top place. It's got a leading the Oscars race. It's got 12 nominations. Leonardo DiCaprio gets left for dead, has to claw his way through ice. 2.5 hours, boom, The Revenant. Go see it.
It's thrilling. Okay. And of course, look, if you've just tuned into your only source of entertainment news from a Christian perspective, you probably haven't heard yet, like the rest of the world, the Network 10 has announced it will be relaunching Survivor Australia. Now, I say relaunching particularly for those who haven't heard this because they might be going, deja vu? Yes, the 7 Network had a go at Australian Survivor, then the 9 Network, actually the other way around.
Yeah, I thought 9 went someone first, had a crack at it before.
Then 7, and now it's the booby prize. 10 is having a go. Of course, they're probably starting off a little better than Channel 9 in that they're setting it on a tropical island, which beats Channel 9's choice of remote Victoria. But in a world of DVRs and TV on demand, 10 may still find themselves getting voted off the island.
Yeah, I dare say. Also, at cinemas, it's been out for a short while. I haven't been able to catch this. I'm very keen to see it. The Big Short, starring as many great actors as you can think of, Christian Bale, Ryan Gosling, Steve Carell, Brad Pitt, in this GFC comedy drama about basically how the world financial system collapsed. Laugh. The Big Short at cinemas now.
And from factual film to factual TV, the ABC is launching this Tuesday an amazing new series sort of based on some great sort of televisual techniques, The Extraordinary Making of You. It's hosted by Michael Mosley. This fascinating series of groundbreaking storytelling about how we're actually made, how we come together. It's sort of a 6-part series. Will be going on 1 hour each, Tuesdays, 8:30 p.m.
All right. In news this week, well, and actually news for about a few weeks' time, on Wednesday, February the 10th, in Sydney at Event Cinemas on George Street, there's a special screening of Brooklyn, and it's so special that Mark and I will be there.
In person.
It's the launch of Real Dialogue, which is these events that City Bible Forum hosts, where a movie gets screened and there is question and answers asked of quote-unquote experts afterwards, which we may be involved in that expert panel, Mark. If you would like a ticket to this screening, go to citybibleforum.org, register now for free tickets
free
to Brooklyn
tickets
on February the 10th,
free
which is a
film,
Wednesday.
And you get to see an ironic T-shirt being worn by Ben.
What more could you want?
And from one set of stars to another, Michael Jackson is involved in a new British television movie. Michael Jackson is going to be the subject of a new British television movie. And you might ask, who is playing Michael Jackson?
Yes. Who is playing Michael Jackson,
it's
I
It's none
ask.
Other than Joseph Fiennes. I know. What? Think about that. Yes, it's in fact a white person playing Michael Jackson in a news story about a particularly amazing car trip that took place in Michael Jackson's life with Elizabeth Taylor in the year that 9/11 terrorist attack took place.
Wow, incredible.
I know.
Now, before we get on to the first segment of the week of this show, what your kids are watching, I believe you have something new for us in 2016, Mark.
I do. We've got to announce the fact that we're going to be, thanks to Horst, who is our content manager at Hope 103.2?
Yeah, Horst. That's
Horst.
Right. Horst.
That's what we're calling him anyway. It suits his more Bavarian character. Horst has decided, and when he wrapped up for the year last year and he looked at the program, the big picture, he said basically, guys, you've only got to achieve really two things to achieve greatness. You've got to be funnier and sooner.
Funnier sooner.
So funnier 2016
sooner. 2016 brought to you by Funnier Sooner.
The big picture, hashtag Funnier Sooner. and in the name of Funnier Sooner, we introduce you a new segment, true or false. Ben, I'm going to pose something to you.
Pop quiz, hot shot.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay. Did you see that grab from Speed? Dennis Hopper saying pop quiz, pot shot, pop
hot,
what?
Hot shot.
Pop quiz, hot shot. Anyway, well, that was, it was working well for true or false.
Right up until then, it was almost funnier sooner.
It really was. Pose for me something that's true or false.
This could be true or it could be false. Okay. True or false? Johnny Depp suffers from thalassohypaxophobia.
That's so true.
Something you'd have to be crazy not to have if you were a mariner.
So true.
It is the fear of pirates.
So true.
Johnny Depp, Pirates of the Caribbean star, is terrified of pirates, which actually led to the filming of Pirates of the Caribbean, in which Depp insisted he was blindfolded during most of his four-hour makeup procedure.
Egad, man.
True or false? Come back later, we'll let you know. We're actually going to move on to a new segment, but hang around. In 4 minutes' time, we'll let you know if that's true or false.
Oh, I thought you were about to tell me that was true. I'm going with true.
Okay.
Okay, what your kids are watching this week. Ever since Katniss Everdeen stepped onto the Hollywood stage, publishers and producers have been struggling to recapture the lightning in a bottle that was The Hunger Games. One contender is a new trilogy based on novels by Rick Yancey. The Fifth Wave stars Chloe Grace Moretz and Nick Robinson, and it shows teenagers comforting the ravages of a worldwide alien invasion. Parents, ready yourself for a fusillade, that's right, a fusillade of angst, followed by another tortured love triangle.
The first wave knocked out all the power. Then the second wave hit. An earthquake strong enough to shake the entire planet.
Cassie! Okay, I got you.
With the third wave, disease spread across the world. By the fourth wave, they were among us.
The others have the ability to inhabit human hosts. They could be anywhere.
We can't trust anyone anymore.
The Fifth Wave is pretty much one of those angsty sort of structures where a bunch of teenagers are left abandoned by adults and trying to find their own way forward. Now, Chloe Grace Moretz, she plays Cassie. Cassie's been separated from her little brother. Her little brother's been taken into a camp, which turns out to be run by the aliens, who also happen to look like us, which I think is just saving on special effects. I think it's just cheap, really. But anyway,
no tendrils,
nothing like that. So these aliens are training up kids to be the fifth wave to wipe out humanity. The four waves that came before were spectacular. I think that's where they spent the special effects budget.
So you went to a preview of this, and from what you were telling me before, it was full of what looked to be the target audience of this film. How did it play?
Look, I was quite surprised, because basically what happened is I went on the same day for a preview of this as the red carpet event for The Hateful Eight, which
is the Quentin Tarantino film that we're about to talk about
very
soon. We'll
be talking about that later. Now, that is apparently a huge effort. So when I came into the cinema, I was saying to myself, oh, this huge line is here is obviously for The Hateful Eight. Fly just barged past everybody. Excuse me.
I'm a film reviewer.
Out of my way. Came right up to the front and said to the fellow, look, I'm here for the preview of The Fifth Wave. And he said, yes, sir, that is the line, which goes out the cinema and around the building. At that point, I just appealed to him. I said, do I look like a teenage girl? Would you please let me in? And he took a good look.
So he just said yes and no and moved to the back of the line. But how did it go with the crowd then?
Well, the crowd was massive. So the turnout tells you something. This series by Rick Yancey is actually quite huge. Parents, if you haven't heard about it, you're probably going to hear more about
yes.
it. But the problem is that the target audience, which filled the cinema and was incredibly excited, also laughed all the way through the film.
So not in a good way, I take it.
Not in a good way, in something of a derisive way.
Oh, yeah?
In the way that only a teenager can let you know that they really do not believe what you're saying.
Ouch.
It was really quite funny in parts that it shouldn't have been funny. The Cassie never really convinces as a poor, torn sort of teenager. She's just, you know, moping around the countryside trying to find somebody until she falls in love with an alien and then falls in love with a former high school jock. And, oh, no, we've got a love triangle. Is this Twilight with aliens? It possibly could
be. Sounds a little bit like it. These kind of Twilight with aliens, dystopian future, save the world, kids of the future, etc. stories, they always seem to have moral lessons either on the surface or underlying the surface. What does Cassie go through? She must have lessons to be learned
here.
She
does.
So does that add depth to the film?
It does. On the surface, the great moral lesson is if you shoot someone, you'll probably feel bad. And don't trust people who are pointing guns at you.
Oh, that's okay. The depth?
These are heavy issues which I think kids today could probably benefit from. But look, It's really a run-of-the-mill sort of stuff, like learning that books can't be judged by their covers, you know, when you're looking at people, that love will conquer all, apparently. Even if you don't have military training, you can somehow get past.
When you're in love with aliens.
It's all course. You need.
Is there anything to come out of this series, do you think? As you mentioned, this obviously gets compared to everything from The Hunger Games right through to The Maze Runner, et cetera, et cetera. So many of these sorts of books to movie series. Is there anything of interest coming here?
Look, there is one thing, and I think it's probably worth thinking about, but it's worth thinking about from the parents' point of view. Okay, child socialization is a really big thing in the film. Okay, the youngest kids are taken off to training camps and things like that by the aliens and made to think a certain way and then sent out to basically destroy the human race. Okay, so, but that's not as far, you know, from fiction as we think. Insofar as in Africa, you do have cases of child soldiers. You had similar things happening in many of the conflicts, you know, in the Balkans and things like that, where children, in fact, and the Middle East, where children are actually enlisted into a cause. They're socialized by things around them. So I think parents can actually sort of benefit from encouraging the kids to say, hey, this isn't just a fantasy. This happens to kids like you around the planet. But then they might want to stop and think, you know, this actually happens in our own society too. Kids have been enlisted by the environmental movement. Kids have been enlisted by games movements, by the clientele who actually want them to watch the film The Fifth Wave. Okay, so in one respect, it's really worth kids being aware that there are other big forces moving around them. To choose to remember that, you know, in Christianity, we basically say you are going to end up worshipping something. You're going to end up following one particular God. It's up to you to choose the right one.
Okay, that's something deep brought out of something that you went impressed with, really.
Not really.
But The Fifth Wave does start Chloe Grace Moretz, Nick Robinson, Liev Schreiber, rated M for mature themes, violence and coarse language, and opened all around the place last week. Mark, before we were talking about what your kids will be watching this week, you posed a true or false
true
statement.
Or false, Johnny Depp suffers from thalassopaxophobia and the fear of pirates.
All of us have wanted an answer, and the answer is
false. Johnny Depp, that's just
ridiculous.
Dude,
you said it with such conviction.
Thalassopaxophobia, it's something I made up. Okay, no, he suffers from coulrophobia, which means he's afraid of clowns, which came about and caused huge problems during the filming of Alice in Wonderland and Charlie in the Chocolate Factory. Basically, he just didn't look at himself the entire time.
Wow.
There you go. There's a little truth in everything.
Yeah. Okay. What's still to come on the show, Mark?
Coming up, well, we hinted at the fact that we've actually got The Hateful Eight coming up in the show, so that's something definitely worth looking at. Also, we've got probably the biggest journalist film for ages, Spotlight, so stay tuned.
Welcome back to The Big Picture 2016, brought to you by hashtag Funnier Sooner.
We are, indeed.
See, look at that.
Look at me, I'm already laughing. Now, we're up to that segment of the show, which is soundtrack, where we have a look at sort of the music behind films. This week's soundtrack choice is a funk song recorded by Kool & the Gang for their 1973 album Wild and Peaceful, and most notably in the Tarantino triumph, Pulp Fiction. We've got Tarantino coming up with The Hateful Eight. We'll talk about that in a minute. The song's spoken vocal is performed by the band's roadie Don Deuce. The song is noted for its Tarzan yell. Have I given it away yet? At the song's end, it's grunting, it's panting. No, this is not some sort of teenage party song. It is, in fact, scored a number 4 as a single and became very popular in nightclubs. Billboard ranked as number 12 for 1974. It is, of course, Jungle Boogie. Jungle Boogie. And of course, featured in Pulp Fiction. Responsible for Pulp Fiction, the Kill Bill movies, and Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino is arguably one of the few filmmakers who is a household name. But his latest work, The Hateful Eight, is an R-rated movie. Now, we normally don't touch R-rated movies.
No, we don't.
We're not interested, frankly. Okay, but Tarantino is such a force on screen, his work is worth discussing. And particularly because people are just going to get along to see it, you should probably be aware of what's going
on. Loads of people are talking about this movie.
Yeah, of course. So we all get a better idea about where the screen culture is right now. Now, Tarantino revels in excessive offensive violence, all sorts of stuff. He's also swings and roundabouts for big topics such as racism and justice and forgiveness. Does he land any punches this film round?
They call him the hangman. When the handbill says dead or alive, the rest of us just shoot you in the back, come up on top of a perch somewhere and bring you in dead over a saddle. But when John Roof, the hangman, catches you, you hang.
Get in, boys!
This here is Daisy Domergue. She's wanted dead or alive for murder. When that sun comes out, I'm taking this woman to hang.
Yeah, if you haven't seen The Hateful Eight and you didn't know what to expect from The Hateful Eight, I think that little clip gives a fair summary of what's going on in The Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
It is a Western. It's more than 3 hours long. Quentin Tarantino, as he really loves to do, he likes to throw in all kinds of film techniques and all things, sorts of things from film history, including on this occasion. Not only has he put together a Western, but he's given it an overture. There's an intermission in
the
film as well.
For those people who don't know, like, an overture is a musical interlude you just listen to.
That's right. Even the fact we have to explain that would suggest that this is kind of film nerd history stuff that Quentin Tarantino has brought back to the big screen. This hasn't really been seen for, like, since the 60s or the 70s. And even the choice of film that he used to film this on hasn't been used for like 50 years. So
they've actually had to re-equip cinemas to show
it. That's right. So all of that is going on with this event. And it is an experience seeing The Hateful Eight. Quentin Tarantino, whether you like his movies or not, I think it's undeniable that his movies are a movie experience. You know you are immersed in some kind of work of art that's in front of you. Now, how shocking and confronting that is to you, a lot of people would say, yes, it definitely is. Other people would want to go back for more, and that seems to be the appeal of Quentin Tarantino to the latter.
Well, let me jump right in and ask the question everybody wants to know. I mean, how offensive is it? It's rated R, and for extreme violence, I mean, how extreme is it?
Yeah, it is. If you've seen any of his other films, I actually found it a little bit restrained, if that's the right word for an R-rated film, and I know it probably isn't.
R for restraint.
We should briefly state, for anyone who hasn't seen this, and I'd imagine a lot of our listeners haven't, and they're not going to, The Hateful Eight is about this posse of no-goods. It's set in America in just probably like 10 years after the American Civil War, in this wintry wasteland. It's just this icy oasis, a little bit like The Revenant, not oasis, like just this wasteland full of snow. And this one sort of, they come, all these no goods turn up in this one kind of cottagey outhouse, like a shop in the middle of nowhere,
yeah,
in the American wilds. And there's a bounty hunter, he's got his prisoner, and he doesn't know whether the men who are trapped in this house with him want to kill him or take his prisoner or what. You don't really know whose side anybody's on. There's a lot of deception going on.
There's a whole lot of, as I understand it, there are a whole lot of sources of hate strung between all of the characters. So it doesn't look like anybody trusts or likes.
There definitely
anyone.
Is. So where it gets increasingly less restrained, the violence escalates across the movie. The first half, there's not that much, and then it turns up in the second. However, again, we just keep going back to, if you've seen Quentin Tarantino stuff before, you pretty know what you're in for. Mm-hmm. And at different points in this film, he tries to shock us with either vulgar scenes, really quite sexually explicit ones. There's loads of foul language in the film, and as we've already mentioned, there's a lot of violence in this. So, yes, you will be offended if any of those things offend you as a film viewer.
Okay, now if there's any chance to actually redeem something from this, he does attempt, often Tarantino does attempt to cover some of the big issues. Racism seems to be one of the big issues. How does he handle it here?
For a sophisticated and quite biting Western that I found this to be, like, as much as he's rebooting from the old, he's like kind of blowing its head off at the same time. And it's quite an exquisite work of art in many ways, The Hateful Eight, all these times, including what he tries to do. I think what he's trying to do with race, which is, it's similar to Django Unchained, his previous film, which I didn't really like. And I thought he also tried to take on race head on, but instead, because he tends to dive in so much into offense. He tries to basically shock us as a film viewer. He can often erode the points he's trying to make. That if he's trying to make a serious point, I think he ends up shooting himself in the foot because it's hard to tell how serious he actually is. Django Unchained, I came out more insulted by its portrait of slavery. Hateful Eight, I wasn't as insulted, but he's trying to put the same thing up, a really serious issue of race, and he even claims that this movie is meant to somehow represent what's going on in America right now, that institutionalized racism continues to this day. So that's what he claims is in there.
Wow, you just don't.
If you go looking for that in the film, I kind of defy you to find it because there is a lot of like racial anger and hatred, that was the word you used, and Hateful Eight, it shouldn't be surprising that it's there. But a lot of characters, black and white, are yelling all kinds of insults and slurs at each other, effectively claiming that the Civil War was divided along racial lines. And again, if he's trying to make a serious point about that, I'm not sure why he just has people insulting each other all the time. It doesn't really get to the dark heart of racism. Instead, it's basically just taking pot shots at the surface. And Quentin Tarantino makes amazing pot shots. Like he writes really, really well. His dialogue is exquisite. But I don't think there's much under the surface. I was a bit disappointed in that, but there's something that jumped out at me about justice and forgiveness in Hateful Eight.
Now, that's a really interesting thing. Now, I've actually seen the film too. Got along to see that. After I finished The Fifth Wave, I needed something to cheer me up. And so I went along to The Hateful Eight, and there's this amazing prolonged scene. In fact, this appearance of Jesus in the film.
Yeah, it comes right at the start of the movie. And this is great for Christian reviewers. We get to talk about Jesus for a few minutes.
Without even trying to do it.
And the opening shot of The Hateful Eight lingers for about 3 or 4 minutes on this stone statue of Jesus on the cross in this wintry wasteland. Now, I took it that it's meant to be something like a visual metaphor for what comes after, which is as soon as a wagon goes past, which has got some of the Hateful Eight on, and then they're going past this statue of Jesus, I took it to mean that they're effectively entering territory beyond forgiveness. Because forgiveness is a constant thread throughout the film. A lot of characters talk about it. A lot of characters talk about how they're not going to give it. A lot of characters joke about whether they will give it, but they won't. And justice gets wrapped up in it as well. But to put Jesus Christ on the cross so front and center at the start of Hateful
Eight.
And
this is a really prolonged shot. This shot goes for minutes.
It left me thinking about what exactly are you trying to say? Now, I think Quentin Tarantino is trying to say that as humans, we don't forgive each other. Like I think he's actually putting that message out there. And even by the end, the resolution of the film, which is a bloodfest, but there's a lot to be said there about how people hold grudges and don't offer forgiveness. In contrast, you go back to this statue of Jesus on the cross earlier in the film and be reminded of how this is constant call through God's word and through the teachings of Jesus about how we should look to forgive each other. And not just, you know, a couple of times, not just once a week, but loads and loads and loads, in contrast to what we see on screen in The Hateful Eight, and you see the bloody repercussions of lack of forgiveness. That's quite a powerful message there in The Hateful Eight, and left me thinking quite a lot about afterwards.
Well, The Hateful Eight stars Samuel L. Jackson, Kurt Russell, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. It's rated R for high impact violence. Let's repeat that. The Hateful Eight is rated R, so extreme caution needs to be advised. It's now showing, well, all over the place. And in particular, if you'd actually like to read more about Ben's take on The Hateful Eight, have a look at this month's Eternity. So Ben's review of the Tarantino Bloodfest is hitting the pews this weekend, the February edition of Eternity. Well worth a look at.
Certainly is. Also worth a look is finding us on Facebook and Twitter. We're all over that place, Mark. And what I do?
Hashtag funnier sooner.
Hashtag funnier
sooner. Thanks, Horst. I don't think we'll ever let that go.
but we share podcasts and videos every week. Please feel free to share and like those with the rest of the Facebook world because Lord knows they need them.
People need more social media. Why don't we invent that sooner?
Coming up on this show, Mark?
Coming up ahead, we still have Spotlight to come. This is quite possibly one of the most powerful sort of philosophical films to come out, a thematic film you really want to see. In fact, as a Christian, one you really should see.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Actually, people should check out thebigpicturewebsite.com, Mark, because it's a corker.
What's the URL for The Big Picture?
Thebigpicturewebsite.com. Yeah, it's actually thebigpicturewebsite.com. So go and check it out. It's got all past shows, reviews, videos, articles, and the like. Go and check it out. But back to this show, Mark. We're up to the press record section of our show. After that, you're actually going to be talking about a new journalistic drama called Spotlight that investigates the intrepid efforts of a team of journalists uncovering the involvement of the Roman Catholic Church in covering up child abuse in America. Now, like many newsroom dramas, it's full of journos convincing reluctant talent to go on record, then racing across town to make deadlines, all in the name of truth. But is that what the modern newsroom is really like? And this is where our press record segment comes in this week, Mark. We sent you off to chat with veteran Seven Network journalist and Sky News presenter Lee Hatcher on what news is really like and how high a value we place on truth.
I'm sitting opposite Lee Hatcher, who would have to be the...
No, I'm looking behind me.
I hesitate to say the grandfather of Christian journalism in Australia.
No. I'm not that old.
No, you're not. But listen, you've had a lot of experience in the media.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've seen more than a few Hollywood-style films of journos racing around and doing their bit.
Yeah.
Is that what it's like? I mean, is that a good job description? When you see a film like Spotlight and you see people chasing the story and deadlines and... Is that what it's like?
It depends on whether it's investigative reporting, which is what Spotlight's about, or like the 24-hour news cyclone that I was involved in with Sky News for 13 years. Now, the frantic rushing around and decisions being made by the second and stuff just going on without any planning, actually, and necessarily without much thought, because you just need to put it on ASAP like 5 minutes ago. We came up with this term because people were saying, oh, the 24-hour news cycle. And we said, no, it's the 24-hour news cyclone. It's enormously intoxicating. It's a great buzz in the midst of it. And in fact, 40-plus years ago, when I first walked into the 2GB newsroom, and there are the phones ringing, the buzz, people yelling, tape spooling, telex machines going on. I was completely arrested. I had no desire to be in journalism, but the buzz got me. So there's that aspect in the immediate sense of media. But in the investigative, no, it's not Hollywood. I get why Hollywood has to portray it as it is, but it's hard, long slog. And it doesn't come up with results easily or quickly. And it doesn't do it much at all these days because of the cost in dollars, in resources, in people.
It's almost like with a film like Spotlight, you're looking into the golden years of journalism.
Yeah. Which we literally call the golden years. And those years have sadly gone. It gives me no joy whatsoever to say it. But the internet, it's not a news story. The internet has absolutely exploded the notion of what journalism used to be. I'm always balanced to say there are many new outlets and opportunities. Your program and multiple programs for The Big Picture is a very good example and a cutting edge example for which you should be congratulated. But journalism is pretty thin on the ground.
Well, in those plot lines that Hollywood does roll out every now and again, truth seems to be a very big thing.
Yes.
You see journos being driven for the truth. They will dig for the truth. They will die, you know, for the truth.
Yep, so it should be.
And is that the case?
Has
truth gone the way of investigative journalism?
Well, there's always been a problem with truth in journalism. It's one of the reasons why I, as a matter of very clear intent, truth is at the very heart. I don't think truth is dealt with well necessarily in some journalism, but truth has to be, not only in journalism, but in any relationship, one of the most, or perhaps the most significant factor. So in journalism, it is a relationship between me, the journo, and you, the viewer, or listener, or reader. If you cannot be confident that I'm being truthful and I can be trusted, there is no basis of a relationship. It's that simple. So with all the dodginess that does go on from time to time in journalism, I keep lamenting it, not through any kind of high and mighty kind of holier-than-thou attitude. It's just a breakdown of relationship, because how many times can I, as a journo, let you down before you just won't bother with me?
You're a Christian, and you've actually taken that stand, I guess, because you're a Christian. Does the truth mean something particular to you as a Christian?
Oh, yeah. One of the things Jesus said about himself is, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. The truth will set you free. Without that high understanding of the truth, you don't get how important it is and how vital it is in relationship between us and God or between each other. It's that critical. We in journalism need to be really careful and probably have pause for thought to understand, regardless of any Christian faith or any religion, just the pragmatics of human relationships in any relationship, marriage, father to son, father to daughter, whatever, they've got to know that you're truthful. For if they don't, and if they can't expect that, you haven't got much on which to base and found a relationship.
If you want to relive those golden years of journalism that Lee was just talking about, well, this is the week to do it. The movie Spotlight tells the story of the one in a million article that made a worldwide difference when an investigation by reporters at the Boston Globe uncovered unusual patterns that went on to reveal systematic protection of pedophile priests. They not only shocked the world, they provided the seeds for a film that demonstrates just how cutting a well-told truth can be.
I know there's things you cannot tell me, but I also know there's a story here, and I think everybody will hear about it.
Do you think your paper has the resources to take that on?
I do. Do you?
The Boston priests molested kids in six different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing.
We haven't committed any long-term investigative resources to the case.
No, we haven't.
And that's the kind of thing your team would do.
Spotlight? Guys, listen. Everybody's going to be interested in this.
Spotlight is just one of those worthy, slow-burning, yet sort of epic ignition. You know, you get to see every moment of an investigation take place, but you never feel like you're being dragged through the library step by step. It's a brilliant film. It stars Michael Keaton as Walter Robbie Robinson, who is the Boston Globe editor, who led a 2001 investigative team who started looking at a fellow called Father John Kagan, a Roman Catholic priest. Gagan. Now, Gagan had numerous accusations of sex abuse leveled against him, but that's not really what the film's about, because in the end, it's not about whether or not Gagan was guilty. The courts established that he was guilty, but what had the church done? The more Robbie's sort of fellow team of reporters, Mark Ruffalo's in there, Rachel McAdams, pull at the threads of his story, they begin to realize that the Boston Archdiocese has actually covered up not only Gagan's crimes, but those of a further 86 priests who'd been abusing the innocent for decades. Mm. And what emerges is not so much a film about the molestation of children, because to be honest, Spotlight actually steers clear of delving into those lurid details. It could have been much worse. It could have been just one of those sort of films that made you feel sick at stomach. But what it really is looking at is the failure of God's representatives to heed his call to take care of those most vulnerable in society. Some films are so powerful that you want to recommend them to others, but you can't. You know, like they're like The Pianist or Sleepers or even The Passion of the Christ can be really difficult to watch. This is powerful, disturbing, engaging, and you should recommend that other Christians watch this film. Spotlight's epic.
Even though it's quite a difficult watch, all things considered. Do you reckon the church had this kind of movie coming?
Absolutely, because Spotlight chronicles a moment where in which people sort of knew that there was a lot of trouble seething underneath how children were being handled in church circumstances, not just in the Roman Catholic Church, but other denominations. There have been decades of rumours. There was no way we could ever avoid this film. And in truth, why would we want to? Christianity has got to be about dealing with sin, not hiding it, not pretending it doesn't exist.
Which is part of the reason why the whole situation actually existed, is because people were covering up and hiding sin.
Yeah, there should be films like this. And it is a body blow. If you sit there as a Christian, you will feel like we were on the team that did the wrong thing. Mm, and that's true, okay? But it's not necessarily the whole truth of the film.
What about God? Like, where does God figure in all in any of Spotlight?
That is exactly where the film sort of lacks, because it's from a secular perspective. So it is right and righteous even in holding the Roman Catholic Church, but in this case, any denomination that tried to cover that stuff up, it is right in holding them accountable. But that accountability seems to swing over at certain stages to include God as well, as if God was somehow responsible for what these men did, or because these men are hopeless and heartless and shouldn't be believed, neither should God, which makes no real sense, in a logical
argument. It probably would make a lot of sense to some people, though. Some people would think just flat out God is responsible for that.
Yeah, but the problem is that God's reputation is being maligned here. And I want to be careful, because there's no doubt that child molestation is a terrible thing. Our hearts should grieve over this. But you don't take in the innocent and punish the innocent for what's going on. No one can say, looking at the situation, that God lacks love, okay? God so loved the world that he died himself in human form on a cross to deal with sin. And no one can say that God doesn't care about justice, because God is so determined to deal with the unjust, like these priests and others, that those who die without repenting, he says, there's a hell for these people waiting. So God is concerned about justice and he's concerned about mercy.
But God doesn't get a look in that regarding the spotlight at all.
In fact, there's not
even... Is he quite a distant figure? Where is
not,
he?
Look, there is not even a good Christian in this film, which I think is one of its failings.
Okay.
Because everybody gets tarred with the one brush. And that's a little unfortunate. It's true that terrible things happened. Don't anybody hear me say I'm playing that down. But it is a little unfortunate that what happens is that there were people involved in the church who were trying to expose this. There are people in the church today who are concerned about how we care for children and making sure that the guilty are held accountable. So to say that the church is somehow going to ignore that is a bit of a problem.
So this is a film about survivors of child abuse and those that perpetrated that child abuse. But who do you think the real victims are in this film? Like, it sounds like there's a number of victims
victims. There's a little stretch in this, and this is a little disingenuous, okay? In fact, I think it's a little unhelpful. The children are the people who are the real victims in the film. They are the victims, and maybe the families too that are wrapped in on that. But the way that there's a particular character played by Mark Ruffalo, one of the journalists, and he actually says, oh, look, you know, I feel like the church took away from me my opportunity to go back to them. One day I always thought I was going to go back to the church, and now I just can't do that. And they've stolen that from me, which is a real...
Oh, so it's like blaming the church.
I know, but worse than that, it's actually extending now all the people offended to anybody who wants an excuse to have never gone back to church. Mark Ruffalo's character's comment is so disingenuous because it's about as real as the person who says one day I would have said something about the minister or the priest or the pastor who was doing something as to say that one day I would have gone back to church if there wasn't this. Look, fess up, if you don't want to go to church, it's because you choose not to go to church. If you don't want a relationship with God, it's because you choose not to. If you want to find the real God, though, he's there.
Right. So you think Spotlight does confuse some matters and maybe is a little bit unhelpful when it comes to representations of God and personal responsibility, but all in all,
and
this
yet
year,
you should
highly
still
recommending
watch it.
This movie.
You should still watch it. It is a film that we need to face. It's almost part of our history. We should own it, look at it, understand it, and then be able to respond, because people do feel this pain and we should understand it, but not let them get confused over sorts of pain that have nothing to do with the issue.
Spotlight is directed by Tom McCarthy, stars Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams, Stanley Tucci, a whole host of others. It's rated M for mature themes and coarse language, and it released in cinemas last Thursday. Insights magazine is a big supporter of The Big Picture. If you head to insights.uca.org.au, check out Russ Matthews' review of Insights. See if he agrees or disagrees with the illustrious Mark Hadley about Spotlight and plenty of other movies. Russ is a great Christian reviewer who's got some amazing insights into all the latest films. So check out his reviews at insights.uca.org.au.
Guys, it's been a heavy show so far. We've had Spotlight just now. Before that, we had The Hateful Eight, and then we had my tirade against The Fifth Wave. So you know, there have been a few things. So to break it all down, what we're going to do is finish the show with Ben's top five films that make him smile, just so you can actually go out on a good note, Steve. I'm saying to you for that.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. As Mark just told us a little bit earlier, it has been a bit of a heavy show, Mark. For the first one of the year, we've dived into The Hateful Eight, The Apocalypse with The Fifth Wave and Spotlight. And the hard times, well, the heavy times are going to continue, but very, very soon we're going to get to my top five list of the films that made me smile. We're going to leave on a smiley note.
Let you people relax.
But before...
A big grin.
Before we get there, Bible Society Australia CEO and social commentator Greg Clark is back again joining us. He did wonders for us last year on this show, and he's ready to take on the big questions, and particularly the big questions that Spotlight raises. And one of those, for example, is, what does the Bible have to say about bad people, sin, and you?
For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. That's from Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 6, verse 23. Well, how did you go for presents this Christmas that's just passed? Gift giving is a tricky thing, isn't it? Uncle Bob, well, he already has everything. I can't give tea towels again. I know, let's give a charity goat. That seems to be the solution these days. But when we look at the gifts that God has given us, it makes ours look even more stupid. To start with, he gave us the gift of the creation itself, this wonderful world that we get to enjoy. He also gave us the gift of the law of knowing what's right and wrong. At Christmas time, we celebrated God's gift of the incarnation, that God became flesh in Jesus Christ. At Pentecost, we celebrate the gift of the Holy Spirit and the spiritual gifts that are poured out on his people. It seems that God has a gift-based economy, which is just as well, because our gift to him tends to be sin. The wages of sin is death, says Paul, but God's gift is eternal life in Christ Jesus. We've moved away from God's good plan for us. We've ruined his world. We damage his children. We disappoint even ourselves. That's what sin refers to. But thanks to Jesus, sin is a temporary problem for human beings who are open to the forgiveness that God offers through Jesus. It is, I'm afraid to say, a permanent problem for those of us who don't. God's gift to us, as the verse tells us, is delightfully eternal. But though temporary, sin is still something all Christians must wrestle with daily. God seems to renew things slowly and carefully, and we have to be patient and exhibit, as someone once said, a long obedience in the same direction.
Welcome back to the Big Picture 2016, full of professionalism.
We used all our funnier and sooner.
That was funnier later. That one was. Whoa. Okay, here we are. End of the show, Mark, and we're going to bring it home as we always do with a top five list. And we thought, after all the heavy material that we've been introducing the year
to. Let's face it, out there people are going, oh, I can't believe, what are they going to do now? Top five animals that died on screen.
Heck no. Instead, we are going to do the top five movies that left a smile on my face.
Five.
Enchanted from 2007, Mark. That Amy Adams kind of live-action fairy tale, you know, where Amy Adams plays a princess, where it starts off as an animated movie, about like a Disney animated movie, but it's not Disney, and then she comes into the real world in New York City. I'm a guy, right? You understand this.
And I've heard so.
I went to a preview of this film and I loved it. I thought Enchanted was just so deliriously
nice. Did
you buy
the t-shirt?
Like, I wish, but I'm a guy, so I wouldn't do that. But instead, like, I wish you could show through this microphone the smile on my face
It's a pretty big smile when you say that film.
When I think of Enchanted, it just made me want to spring out of my seat and whistle a happy tune for the rest of my day. As Amy Adams said, those kind of funny songs about doing exactly that, whistling and working. And it was a really good parody, like homage thing to Disney princesses, and for some reason I thought it was the business. I thought it was great, and so I still continue to smile about Enchanted from 2007.
Four.
But now for something completely different. This is something of a curveball choice for this top five list, given what I'm about to talk about didn't actually appear in this film that it's that's related to. So,
and that's why you smiled?
The film is Dirty Rotten Scoundrels from 1988. Really funny Michael Caine, yeah. Steve Martin, con man on the Riviera movie.
Enough reason to smile, but you've got an extra one.
It is. I've got this. They gave us an additional one. There's a teaser trailer. Go and type in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels teaser trailer, something like that.
Oh, I know.
And
this.
What will come up is just the picture of Steve Martin and Michael Caine just walking along the Riviera, like hands in their pockets, looking smart, smiling at the ladies, that kind of thing. And there's a voiceover talking about something like, if you want a movie where people are really nice and you see the decency of humanity, etc., etc., don't come and see this movie because that's not the kind of movie it is. And when they get to the end of the voiceover, I'm all smiling and laughing already. Steve Martin pushes an old lady off the walkway into the Riviera. At the same time, you should look on the left because Michael Caine pushes fairy floss into the face of a boy.
Oh, you
and
see,
Mark,
you missed
I'm still
that.
Smiling.
I know,
now, what does this say about me as a human being? I'm not really sure.
You don't like small children or old.
But I remember that was in 1988. I was, to give my age away, 12 years old. I distinctly remember seeing that trailer and really wanting to see that movie. And I was actually disappointed when the bit with the old lady being pushed into the water wasn't in there. That left me not smiling as young Ben.
Do you know who I feel for? Your grandmother.
There's
something there.
For the record, I never did that.
Three.
2001 Zoolander. Now, I haven't just picked Zoolander because Zoolander 2 is coming out in about 2 weeks' time.
Oh, so you smiled at this long before you heard about
the second
one.
I
laugh at his earlier stuff.
I thought I'd ordered this list to sort of like give a bit of a indication of where my humor lies and a bit of diversity across the years, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm coming to realize about myself, and I really need to go away and think a lot deeper and harder about this. I tend to smile at like weird, faintly, I wouldn't say cruel, Mark. I wouldn't say cruel, but people having things happen to them that may be verging on not so nice.
What sort of bit of Zoolander did you particularly smile at?
Well, like that jitterbug scene, you know, to the Wham song Jitterbug.
When they were dancing in the service station.
In the service station, and this is a bunch of male models, including Zoolander, played by Ben Stiller, if you haven't seen this. And I'll try to, how can I do it if you haven't seen it? There is a scene involving petrol male models dancing and jitterbug that ends in spectacular combustive fashion. That I'm still smirking about to this day, Mark. But everything from remember the opening sequence where they're at the fashion awards and you get Hansel coming across on the screen. Just Hansel makes me smile. He's so hot right now makes me smile. And the fact that David Bowie showed up on the catwalk and led to walk off, that made me smile. And then just throwaway lines from that movie, like, good story, Hansel, makes me smile, Mark. That's why Zoolander comes in at number 3. 2. This is a personal choice. I might do a bit of backstory on this one and say, similar to you, why not? Because that's what these top fives are about. They're about us.
We're about exposing ourselves to the audience.
Particularly when it's a top five of what made me smile. So yes. I'm not saying that this is a universal list. It obviously can't be. It just applies to me. There are plenty of movies that you, for example, you have great personal investment in. A movie such as, the Lord of the Rings series Alien or various other sci-fi movies.
I met
movies.
My wife watching Alien, yes.
There you go. Or if does Doctor Who have movies? If he doesn't, why not?
Well, he has Christmas specials.
There you go. You
we don't
love
like
those.
To get into it.
You love
some people have called them telemovies.
You want to reach out and hug them. You just want, even if they're not the greatest movie in the world, you have this really strong affection for them. I don't know, you're not alone. There are plenty of people out there that they could admit at a pinch that that movie's not that great.
How's this but suddenly become about me?
You have a strong, just pushing it back on you. To explain why, number 2 is the 2010 movie version of The A-Team, which most people did not like. They didn't laugh. They actually laughed in derision, not with it.
Such as I am now.
Please. Apart from me, I think I was the one person in the world and the one professional reviewer who gave that 5 stars. I kid you not, I gave that 5 stars in Empire magazine. Go online, check it out. Ben McKechnie, 5 stars, A-Team. It left me with a massive smile on my face.
I've just died.
And not because I was trying to play a joke on everybody, like, I gave that 5 stars. I loved it because I loved the A-Team TV series as a kid. For anyone who didn't watch that show in the 80s, more fool you, and I hope you go out and see it. That was such a great TV show and such a massive part of my childhood. I was so pumped.
You know, you really should wrap this up.
Wait, I was so pumped by the time. I'm still smiling right now. I was so pumped by the time I got there. I had to give it 5 stars, and I'm still smiling about it right now. 1. Now, here's more stories about my childhood, Mark, and movies that I loved and probably other people didn't. Okay. National Lampoon's Vacation comes in for me, 1993. Uh-huh.
Long-term listeners to The Big Picture will know that National Lampoon's Vacation has possibly been featured on this series for probably about 7 times now because you keep reliving it with your family.
Oh, yeah.
That might be the case.
Maybe 6
Why
times.
Why not make you smile?
We might have done that. How well do you remember the first National Lampoon's Vacation with Chevy Chase and his family heading across America?
Fairly well. Man, grandma strapped to the roof.
There you go. Now, that's not the scene that I'm thinking of that makes me smile, although
it does make me worry about your relationship with your grandmother.
Although I do tend to chuckle, and that's right, does have a close relationship with number 3, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Now, the one scene, and there are many of scenes that like just make me smile internally, externally, all the way through, Mark, but there's one in particular that has Chevy Chase... He's having a picnic with his family, and he has a sandwich. And then there's this lady that he's been making eyes at, which I'm not condoning that, but he's making eyes at a lady.
Oh, the one in the sports car?
The one in the sports car, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this music kicks in the background, and he's still got his sandwich. So he starts dancing with his sandwich. He's a grown man dancing with a sandwich. Now, that should make you smile. That's right. But it goes a little bit further. And then, well, I've actually got the clip. I can play for you, and hopefully the audio will explain just how funny this scene is.
Mom, my sandwich is all wet.
They're all wet, but... Oh, God. The dog went on the picnic basket.
The dog did something on the picnic basket that made the sandwich wet. And number 1 at the movies that made me smile and the scenes in which that caused me to smile, That one from National Lampoon's Vacation 1983. Dog wee sandwich.
I think you're easily satisfied.
Okay. I'm still smiling. Oh,
look, on that note, let's while you recover your breath. Coming up next week, we've got a great show.
How can we
for
move
you.
On from that?
Well, we shouldn't, but we will. Okay. Coming up next week, what have we got, Ben?
Oh, mate, we're going to be talking about what your kids will be watching on TV in 2016.
That's great. And we also actually review two Oscar contenders you should be aware of, Room and Steve Jobs.
Plus, the truth about taking your baby to the cinema.
Is it fun?
Find out next week. I then will be, as I am right now, Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.